So we are at Rutgers University in Newark, New Jersey, and as part of the Temple Dynamics of Learning Center's adventures into the science of educating, we're actually talking with a colleague of Paula Talal's, Alec Gates. Now, what's surprising to me is that you are professor and department chair in Earth and Environmental Sciences. But there's another link here, isn't there? Why don't you explain to me why Paula thought you'd be a good person for us to talk to?
Well, the main thing, I've been working with Paula on a project that we started. We just got an LSAMP grant, which is a Lewis Stokes Alliance for Minority Participation. We got this last year, and so we were running it this first year, and Paula was giving a talk on her results from Fast Forward. And so after the talk was over, I listened to the talk and I said, boy, we might be able to try this on this new population that we're bringing in of in this LSAMP. And the LSAMP is where we try to increase the number of underrepresented minorities in STEM disciplines. And so we thought that maybe this would be a way to have them be more successful in their undergraduate education.
Okay. Let's do some of the alphabet soup, all
Okay.
right? So, because it's for people in other disciplines, other areas, and even for parents, a lot of this is baffling.
Sure.
The National Science Foundation, the NSF,
Right.
has the Lewis Stokes Alliances for Minority Participation program. That's the LSAMP thing. First of all, tell me what that is and how that came to be.
Okay, that is a program at the National Science Foundation. It's 20 years old this year, in fact, and they have 41 alliances nationwide. And the alliances are a group of institutions, or sometimes a single one, that will work together to increase the number of underrepresented minorities in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, that will graduate and be successful, be able to pursue careers. So there's about they have about 200,000 students participants in the program throughout the United States.
Now, according to this report, the definition here of underrepresented minorities, or URMs, is African Americans, Hispanic Americans, and American Indians.
Well, it includes a few other,
But there must be a few others as well, right?
right? I mean, Native Pacific Islanders, I think Alaskan Natives are also within the group. But, we had kind of concentrated on what we have here at Rutgers. There's not that many Pacific Islanders.
But this is the number one campus in the United States for diversity.
Yes.
How could you quantify for me what the problem here is, the challenge that's being addressed here in terms of underrepresented minorities, specifically in science, technology, engineering, mathematics subjects? I mean, how much of a challenge is there?
Well, the problem is that a lot of people will go into it or want to go into it, and some of them go into it as undergraduate majors, but getting them completely through it is a difficult task. And a lot of the problem is there are not that many role models and mentors in the field, so you tend to, as when things get a little hard, you're there by yourself. And sometimes these, that they lose hope and drop out of the field. And so the big problem that we found is that within our group is retention. A lot of them will make it to that first, those first tough courses and drop out. And so the real efforts that we've been making is try to get them to make it all the way through and graduate. And I can't, if you were asking me for numbers on, every school is different as to how they will graduate. But obviously the it was troublesome enough around the United States that they went to this program and have significantly increased the numbers that have graduated. So.
Is it when you interact with kids like this, you're actually working in Earth Environmental Sciences and so on.
Right.
What's the representation in there? Is there something, which of the subjects are intrinsically easiest with which to hook people into, you know, to build their excitement?
I mean, this is a tough one, because the reality is the easiest one, especially here. You know, Rutgers Newark is in a spot. It's in the middle of a city. A lot of the kids are in their first, you know, kid people in their families to go to college. Yeah. And so it's very difficult to convince people that, you know, you're going to do anything besides what they know. And so most of them come in and they want to be doctors or dentists or things like that. And so and we don't cover medical areas. This is National Science Foundation. NIH will cover, National Institute of Health will cover medical. We'd cover everything but. And so to get them to consider other things besides something in the medical field is difficult. So even to get them started is not an easy task.
Well, but has it ever changed? I mean, whenever you're going, making those kind of choices in school, I mean, the parents are always saying, can you get a job doing that?
Exactly. So it's still, you know, especially, look, I mean, I'm a geologist by trade. Geology is the absolute worst in terms of diversity, I think, of anything, but certainly of all the sciences, they're the worst. And so to get, you know, underrepresented minorities interested in that is, boy, that's a tough call. So you have to kind of make everything relevant right up front. You know, you want to drill for oil or clean the environment. Those are things that you can go into, but you got to put that relevance in there for, you know, to get, you know, people who are unsure, you know, and that's the main thing. You're getting people who are kind of unsure about going into these areas because they're difficult. And so to have them go into these difficult areas where there's not that sure part, it's not an easy sell.
So the reports that have been coming out, could you summarize what the findings have been, what some of the positive directions that have been sort of agreed upon are, and so on?
You mean in the LSAMP program?
Yeah.
Well, the LSAMP program is actually quite successful, and in fact, there was a magazine that rates diversity programs, and they were one of the top 10. Diversity programs in the sciences in the United States. And, you know, what they do is they put all the onus on the schools. You know, basically they say, you know, we'll give you the money, you know, here's your money, you get the 5 years worth of money, and if you can double the number of graduates from underrepresented minority groups over the 5 years that we're going to give you the money, you can reapply and we'll give you 5 more years of money. And so, and they don't, you know, as I've told, I get the group together and we work, churn through this proposal for a year, and we always along the way, I said, you know, this is a labor of love. It's not, you don't expect to get rich off of it. I mean, you know, it's a big grant, it's $5 million, but there's 8 schools involved and how many different sciences departments in each one of those schools. So by the time you get to the end, there's very little money. And so people have to do it because they really want to do it. And so with the small amount of money and, you know, and a big task, you know, because doubling the number of underrepresented minorities in 5 years is no easy task. I mean, you have to really work hard. And so it puts a lot, it really has to be that labor of love of those schools to really want to put that effort in and get it to work.
One of the things that I've found as we've been having these conversations with people about the science of educating in general, starting from the Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center, talking to the folks at UCSD and so on, other campuses like Rutgers, people at Berkeley and so on. One of the things that I bring up just to orient people is to remind them what's being said about the state of education and the state of educating. And from month to month it varies, but there's always some magazine cover I can pull out and say, oh, here's Time magazine, it happens to be What Makes a School Great, or, you know, here's this cover of Science magazine. It was all about science, language, and literacy. Did you see this one? This was an amazing cover.
Yeah.
This was children aged 7 studying nuclear physics in 1948. So things have changed, obviously. You obviously saw the recent New York Times magazine, Learning by Playing, mm-hmm. Use of Video Games, and so on. So we're always interested in the context for this, not only the underpinnings of the science. So when you talk about schools and how do you get schools motivated and so on, that's why I was asking the question about what have been the most effective techniques you've found. How does this dovetail with the sorts of things that I'm asking other people about as we go along?
Well, I mean, you know, there are what they call best practices that, you know, because as I said, this program has been around for 20 years. So they have found a lot of what the best practices are within for these LSAMs. And so, you know, what you do basically is to start off with is to go with the best practices. And so that's what we started off with. And these best practices, for example, of course, straight up tutoring. If somebody has a problem, they can't get through it, we, you know, we will provide tutors for them. And what, the way we do it is you get everybody you can out of the school. And the kids who are stronger, you know, have already have high GPAs, 3.5 or above, and have taken the classes and done well in them, you know, then not only do they can work as tutors and get, we pay them stipends to tutor the, you know, the underclassmen. And, you know, not only will they help them to understand things, but also this upperclassman is a role model for them, you know, that they can do it as well. So making a path, a clear path for them to be able to go from where they are now to a successful person, that's one obviously useful thing. Now, I mean, the big thing, though, with an LSAMP is you're putting together what they call a learning community. And, you know, rather than the typical college where everybody's in competition with each other to see who gets the best grade, this is to everybody to help each other. So it's a whole community that works academically and also emotionally. You know, you have to have that emotional support to be able to get them to be successful. And so rather than, you know, only a few being successful and getting through like the college is supposed to be, this is everybody works to get everybody through. And so it's a whole kind of new way that they really try to do these things. And so the tutoring is part of that. Mm-hmm. They have what are called peer-led team learning groups, where you put a bunch of students together in a room who are all from the same class. You put a leader in there who's already taken the class, already got an A, works with the professor, and you have the students start asking, talking about what they're having weaknesses in. Because, you know, even when I went to school, you'd think you'd study everything, and you'd sitting out in front of the room waiting to go in, and somebody would come in and say, hey, did you study this? And of course you hadn't, and so you try to cram it in your head at the last, but forget everything else. So, you know, rather than have that, it's if you don't understand that completely, probably somebody else doesn't either. And so by getting the whole room to share, you know, and be guided by someone who's with the professor and working together, really gets them all to be much more motivated. And also to have that the rest of that group around them, to see that you have a whole bunch of people that are working together to help you become successful. You're not just on your own. You know, so there's a couple of parts then that really play together in that. And so those are two things that they need. Then there's support for doing, you know, getting them involved in research, because, you know, you get involved in a research project and really focus on that, that's a great motivation for people to stay in their discipline and stay and graduate. So we have that. We've got things that are, you know, counseling for the students, you know, tell them what to take, what not to take, where we can really help them out, you know. And so there's a whole list of, you know, some people are using cyberspace, communication networks, things like on Facebook pages that they can go through, social networking, basically that they can do that with this. And so, it's trying to create a group that you don't think you're by yourself, that there's a clear pathway and everybody's enjoying it and going to get there at the end. And so that's kind of really where this is the crux of it.
Yeah, well, you mentioned that a lot of these kids are first generation into higher education, into universities and so on. Is there a special problem there in getting the parents involved, or is that something you're specifically aiming at as well?
Well, I mean, we do invite the parents when we have information sessions and things like that to bring them involved, and certainly we're willing to talk to them. But that, you know, that it depends on really the student to sell, you know, the parents more than us. We'll provide background. We have flyers. As I said, they can come to the information. We're happy to answer questions and things like that. And hopefully that is gives them enough support so that they will stay with it. But certainly, yeah, that's a big problem, of course, with a first-generation student who doesn't understand that there's a lot of opportunities in a lot of different directions.
So, I mean, how did you get into this in the first place?
You really want me to go back that far? Well, I was a scientist. I became department chair, and all of a sudden you don't quite have the amount of time to be really on that cutting edge of research. And so one of my colleagues kind of invited, I started off with a GK-12 program, and he kind of invited me into this to work on that. And, you know, all of a sudden I found that, and I'd always been kind of involved in outreach and things like that and education. So I got in the GK-12. Then I went to go with what's called an OEDG, which is an opportunity for enhancing diversity in the geosciences, another National Science Foundation. And when I was applying for that grant, they said, well, you have to, if you really want to, you want to get this grant, you've got to connect with an LSAM. What's an LSAM? So I had to connect with another LSAM, which was the University of Houston I started with. And but we contacted the head of the LSAM program at National Science Foundation, and he said, I want an LSAM in New Jersey. I said, okay. So that's kind of where the whole thing started. I worked with a guy who's gone now, who's the brother of the mayor, Cory Booker. His name was Cary Booker. And he and I really started working this together. He left, and I kind of picked up the whole rest of the program. So
you talked about social networking and Cory Booker. I mean, there's been a recent announcement, hasn't there, about New York with yes. Mark Zuckerberg
Absolutely.
Giving
yeah.
or making available $100 million to
right.
Cory Booker, the mayor of
yes.
New York.
Yeah.
Spoken about quite highly, as I understand it, in terms of education.
Yeah, he's you know he's been very helpful, you know, in some of these projects. That's part of the reason. Used to be very good because you know you get into one of these urban school systems, and Newark is a tough school system. And so when I used to come into a room and have Cary Booker, who looks very similar to Cory Booker, walk in the room with me, we would get respect. So it would make things much easier to get a lot of the programs going.
Now, when you went into science yourself, when mm-hmm. you started at university, were you from an academic family, from a scientific background, or were you a first generation yourself?
Well, I was from an academic background, but I was actually the black sheep of the family because the whole rest of my family are artists. So being a scientist, I was a black sheep of the family. I always tell artists that story, and they always get a good laugh at it, because the artist is always the black sheep of the family.
Right, right. this is a flip side, isn't it?
Yes.
So
they don't understand what I'm doing. And, oh, do you have anything that looks nice? No.
Do you what's your sense at this point? I mean, you're involved at the cutting edge here in terms of STEM and so on. One question I've been asking a lot of people is that in his inaugural address, President Obama said that they would restore science to the rightful place.
Right.
Where is that?
Well, you know,
what's
the rightful place? Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, being a scientist, I can tell you that that's the key to the future is going to be science. I mean, obviously, a lot of our problems that we face now have been created by science, but if we're going to fix them, we're going to have to fix them with science as well. So whether it be the environment or energy or medicine or any of those other things, a lot of the future to be able for us to be successful, I think, is going to have to come through science. And obviously, a lot of the opportunities for people in careers and things like that will also be science. I mean, if you look at the Department of Labor statistics, they put the 30 hottest fields to go into over the next 10 years, and 21 of the 30 require science degrees. So it's recognized that science is important. And I think that's where we have to go with it, is we're going to have to move more in the direction of science and get people more connected with it.
So, you mentioned sort of a shortage of the people that you deal with actually in your own geology area. I mean, have you thought about how to? I sort of understand this. As I said to you when you came in, you've been stuck in the rain out there. You're a little bit late. Everybody looked like there was some panic going on, and that we'd be all bent out of shape and so on. And I said to you that my understanding was that you dealt with epochs like the and land masses like the Rodinian, which formed 1.1 billion years ago.
Yes.
split apart, and then there was various other reformulations of the continents until we ended up with Pangaea 275 million years ago. How long is that? I mean, my point is here that given that kind of enormous time scales that we're talking about, is that how do you attract people into that kind of a discipline when what they're concerned about, as you said, is now and can I get a job and how do I pay my bills?
Well, if you want, now you're going to go into my other grant, you know, and that's my opportunity for enhancing diversity. And what I've done is because the problem in you go into school and everything is very theoretical and academic. And so especially when you're dealing with kids who don't have, you know, as I said, they have their first generation who are even considering going to college, they don't really care. You know, so for example, they teach them the stratigraphy of the Grand Canyon. Grand Canyon is fabulous. They've never been to the Grand Canyon. You know, maybe one has been. The rest of the class have no clue what you're talking about or why you should even consider it. So what I do is I go in the classroom and I put together these hands-on devices where I can teach them something by having them do things and have fun. So I have this one called the oil game, where I teach them something about all, including all the stratigraphy of the Grand Canyon and things about the control of oil games. And I say, okay, now I'm going to put you in groups, and I'm going to give you some money. And then you guys, if you can figure out how you drill for oil, what's the best way, and you can drill for oil, you'll win money. And all of a sudden, you know, we've done some background work on this where I have an outside evaluator. And we go in there and, you know, out of five, you know, we say, would you like to go into geology? Three being neutral, five the best. We get 9% will hit 4-0 on the five. Everybody else couldn't care less about going into geology. We play the game, 66% of the class is 4 and 5. Because we put it in terms that they can understand. Ah, now I see what you do with that. And that's the problem. Is a lot of the sciences as we teach it, you know, I mean, you have to learn that theory. But if you can't put it in context in this day and age, why should they go into that?
But it's interesting. I also want to follow up on this point because you cited this Department of Labor statistics showing that the 21, what would you say?
21 of the 30. Yeah.
Require scientific background. Right. Now, you know as well as I do that until the recent recession, shall we call it, that people were not going into science at all. They were going into money markets or economy, or they were doing the traditional, being doctors and lawyers, because that's where the jobs and the careers appeared to be.
Right.
So you're having to portray this as, obviously, you also have a good chance of getting a job if you're a geologist, right?
That's absolutely right.
Do you find that when you get people at least intrigued, if that hook works, does then something take over and does the subject matter itself become compelling?
Well, I don't know if we're far enough along to really say
that. Well, I don't know. I mean, look at your tie there. You've got dinosaurs on it, right?
I have a collection of geology ties.
So that kind of stuff, I mean, doesn't that have an intrinsic appeal? Or?
Sure. Yeah, you know, they all see it, and everybody always likes the tie. So it's a good thing to catch people's attention. Yeah. And so I use it in that way. And but, you know, it is. Once they get into it and see, oh, yeah. You know, so we have a mining thing where how do you mine things out of the ground? Where does metal come from? You know, so we have a mining thing. You know, and we have environmental stuff. What happens if you spill things in the groundwater system? What happens to it? So we have one that they go through that. And so we have a bunch of things. A tsunami tank. I got the tsunami tank. We can generate tsunamis, see how they work. And so, but they put their hands on it.
Right, because I make this point often to people that you know, that they, I say, well, trying to point out the importance and the ubiquitous nature of science.
Right.
And you ask people where the science stories are, they say New York Times on a Tuesday. Well, it's not. It's on the front page every day, right?
Right.
You know, there's...
Maybe not enough, but...
Global warming. Well, no, because there's global warming, there's the economy, there's decision-making under uncertainty. There's a lot of those stories are fundamentally science stories.
Right.
And I think that's one of the things that these programs...
But you have to make that connection because the stuff you learn in school... I mean, it's like, you know, if you're going to play an instrument. I mean, and you start out, you know, I've got a son who wants to play an instrument. And you start off with scales. You know, they want to make songs. You know, he wants to have it sound like a song. And if you start them off with scales, it's hard to figure out how that scale is going to lead to that song. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's why if you can infuse a little bit inside of the as you go along, I think you can get, you know, kids more interested rather than having it be something that's so alien to them. Then they can get some interest and that drives them on, you know?
So is the Lewis Stokes Alliances, do you know what the history of that was and how it started? I mean,
well, it's, you know, it was really it started because, you know, obviously the United States has been falling behind in, you know, science and technology, engineering and math over the years. I mean, I always say people, you know, that the end of the Cold War is a double-edged sword because it really drove science for so long.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you get rid of the competition and there's no reason to really be so pro-science anymore. And so all of a sudden people stop going into it. And, you know, it wasn't as big a deal as it used to be. And so they started some programs really mostly to improve, you know, increase the number of people going into these areas, you know, from the National Science Foundation. Obviously, they're concerned with that. And so that's what there are a bunch of programs that they have. But clearly, you know, they looked at it and they said, well, you've got all these underrepresented minorities and they're so small percentages in each of these fields. I mean, geology still, it's 2%. Are from underrepresented groups. It's terrible. And so, you know, there was the problem that you're not getting, you know, you want to make it available to everybody. And so obviously, whether it was self-selected or something was wrong in the industry, you were not getting underrepresented minorities in these areas. So part of it was to do that. Part of it was to increase our science and technology workforce in the United States. I mean, and so that was kind of the justification for starting this. It was an AMPRA, an Alliance for Minority Participation, when it first started. And then, you know, it grew from there because it's a successful program.
All right, so let's think about Rutgers just for a minute specifically. Most diverse campus in the United States. What are they studying here? You just said there's no medical option here, so
right.
Which sciences are the most popular?
Well, I mean, certainly the most popular is biology. People still want to become doctors because they're still first generation. Mm-hmm. So that's the most popular, and that doesn't count for us. So we go after other things, which is much more difficult. You know, we have to convince people that when they come in that there are jobs in other areas besides being doctors. And that's a tough part. That's the toughest sell when you go in that, starting with this, of anything else. You know, we have 800 biology majors on this campus, and most of them want to be doctors. Mm-hmm. And so you have to kind of convince them. So I go into there and I say, well, you know, there's a very small percentage actually going to make it to medical school. So you guys, there's other things. You keep your options open. You know, there's biotech fields and environmental fields and all kinds of other opportunities for you as a biology major. You don't just have to be a doctor. And, you know, I don't know, some people listen.
So, the biology is followed by what? I mean, there's obviously a fairly strong neuroscience contingent on this campus and molecular biology.
That's mostly, of course, at the graduate level for the neuroscience. I mean, the big thing here is business. That's the number one. Yeah. You know, and then biology is probably out of the business school, the biology is strong. Psychology is probably the next one up. And then, you know, it peters down from there. So really the places we're drawing from do not have a lot of majors. It's not an easy task. So, you know, chemistry.
One of the people I've spoken to over time is Michael Crow at ASU, Arizona State University. And of course, what they did there was to sort of knock down a lot of these disciplinary silos and organize them around functional areas, if you like. Does that sound like it has appeal to you?
Well, in my own
conceptually?
Department, I do that. Yeah. My department is, it's just a crazy department because everybody is kind of working together from different directions. So we have chemists and biologists and physicists and all to get kind of together as earth scientists. We're solving environmental issues. And so that's worked very well for me on that direction, especially, you know, we're in the best spot for that because it's probably the most polluted place in the world. And so it's a good place to study it. And so that's what I've kind of hit it from directions. You know, some of the other departments are a little bit, but not that much. Yeah. No. I mean, that may be the best way to go, too. Yeah.
So you say that you came from a family of artists, actually. Yeah. So how did you even get interested in science in the first place, then?
I had a second cousin who was the state geologist of Maine. And so when I was the little kid picking up rocks, and he encouraged me. So, oh, yeah, you know, and I guess I always liked walking. I guess the big thing was when I was a teenager, I used to go hiking in the hills around, you know, near my house. And, you know, I said, boy, I like doing this. I got to find me a job where I can walk around the woods and get paid for it. So that was my whole, and I got to do it.
So when you're talking to these young folks just about to embark on their trajectory, and you want them to be scientists, and you see a lot of these kids coming through, I mean, what is your advice to a young want-to-be scientist?
Well, I mean, it's probably always, you got to work hard at it. You got to want it, you got to work hard, you got to stick with it, you know, and it'll be worth it in the end, you know, you'll get a nice, you know, job that you'll easy to get a job in, and it'll be interesting and it'll be challenging, you know, and you kind of have to start talking about, you know, goals in life to, you know, to keep things challenging for you, to keep you interested, and, you know, so kind of that's the main thing you talk to them. Now, as far as the STEM, I mean, I give them a big speech at the, you know, for the LSAMP, I give them a big speech and get them going and motivational type of stuff.
Is it hard to get, when you talk about this sort of mentoring thing and making the upperclassmen into the role models and so on, and women, actually women, how are they underrepresented yet again as well in this
that's
area?
That's not what the LSAMP covers.
No, but it's just, but the...
In certain areas, absolutely. In other areas, you know, it's pretty good. I mean, you know, in biology, it's pretty even. You know, engineering, not even in the ballpark. It's mostly male. So it just depends on, you know. I mean, even in the, I was at National Science Foundation for a panel review the other day, and the person in charge was telling me that in oceanography, they actually have more women than men are underrepresented, and they have to encourage more men to apply for money than women because they're giving all the money to women, which is, you know, a big turn of events.
All right, so just let me ask you one last little thing here. Given all this stuff that you're wrestling with on a daily basis, what are you optimistic about?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of the stuff we are doing, I think this LSAMP program, we're trying new things with it. You know, you get the basic starting point, and then you try new things. You know, I like to experiment. So this is why this Fast for Word, when I heard this that Paula had, I said, wow, you know, we've got to try this, because if this really could work, then, you know, it looks like it'll be great. And we found another one for math that's kind of similar, that's already, it's, you know, packaged and sold and everything else, and we have the kids do that. And we ran a pilot this summer, you know, with just on a voluntary basis to do a little of the Fast Forward and a little of this other program. It's called Alex. And the kids were just, you know, they really took to these things, which was really, you know, because basically it's like this. You can buy a gym membership, and if you don't show up to the gym, your muscles aren't going to get any bigger. And so you got to, if they're going to use it. And so we got these two groups in there. They were just glued to those computer screens, doing whatever they could to get ahead. And so to see that kind of motivation, I think looked like it was going to be a great thing. And so that's why we're going to spread it to the whole thing. And actually, we're going to see if the whole LSAMP, we're doing a study this fall here with this Fast Forward, and then we're going to present it to the entire LSAMP next June at their joint annual meeting, And you know, if we come up with results that people, and then the whole group might want to use that.
But in general, beyond those kind of programs as well, as I cited this New York Times Magazine cover, you know, the learning by playing, can video games transform schooling? Plainly, there's a lot of good evidence out there, and there's lots of other studies as well by people from not only the TDLC, Javier Mavean using his robots and so on. There's lots of ways in which technology can be used as an additional teacher's aid. And because obviously teachers, shortage of teachers, teachers' time, teachers' availability is one of the rate limiting factors here. So all sorts of anything that can do that allows the child or the student to be actually working by themselves as well. Obviously seems to pay dividends here. So you, I assume, were sympathetic to this kind of approach.
You don't want to get me, you're trying to get me onto the cynical part of my personality. You know, you've only seen me being a positive part. You know, I mean, my whole trouble is when you put, I mean, and it's, maybe I shouldn't say it, but the problem is when you put 300 channels of just junk on television for a kid to watch and video games of all kinds of stuff and all stuff, and then you expect them to look at a book. I mean, why would they want to? You know, so the power of the tools of television, of video games, of things on computers to be able to educate people has been drastically underutilized over the years. Instead, it's been just total entertainment. And so then, you know, you've got to have education competing with this, you know, really advanced entertainment area. And that's half of the problem with why people don't want to do it. But if you can marry those two together, obviously that would be, you know, then you could get kids to learn using these things. But it's been underutilized over the years. Obviously things like this are just, you know, the beginnings of what could be possible as far as educating people using these technologies that have been used for purely entertainment purposes.
Well, this term about disruptive technologies, whereas in fact what they're doing is causing a refocusing.
Right.
Disruptive is almost a kind of a... But I'm thinking now not only the stuff that Paula does, the stuff that Mike Merznick does. You know, there's a nice perspective paper in the current issue of Neuron by Daphne Bavelier. On the whole, and there's a paper recently just came out on the whole notion of using video games that she worked on with Alex Puget, talking about the capacity to improve kids' decision making processes. A lot of these things, plainly, although you look at them and sort of say, "Ah, games, how bad can that be?" If they're the right kind of games, one suspects.
Absolutely agreed. Even television, you know, you go on the television and it's, you know, ugh, you know, I have kids. They watch the stuff they watch, turn that off, you know. And it's just, as I said, the technology that we have is just drastically underutilized where it could be used for really positive results, just like these. And obviously, you see things like this where, you know, where they start doing something and all of a sudden the kids catch on and they start becoming much more productive with it. I mean, there's a lot that can be done with these things. And in the past, you know, everybody goes for that recreational or education or entertainment value. So I think this is a vast opportunity, as far as I'm concerned, for making these technologies able to educate the public rather than just, it's almost uneducating the public on a lot of the things that they have now. So there you go. There's my cynicism.
But we have to get back to what you were optimistic about.
Well, the optimistic about is that if you start using these things and turning them into something that might be something positive, where people would use them to learn, you know, then it becomes, you know, a powerful tool. I mean, then it becomes one of the most powerful tools you could have to be able to use as mass education, you know.
But the other thing you were talking about there, about the practicalities, the and your own experience of they are with a rock and some instruction and mentoring about the history of this rock and so on and so forth. How do you've also got to be able to get that make that available as well? I mean, how difficult do you, in your department, for example, do you have field trips to go and look at the stratigraphy of
Not the Grand Canyon, too far.
Of here.
Right, yes, absolutely. I teach a course in field geology, in fact. And we were thinking about going out tomorrow, but I think we're not. But
looks like another wet tomorrow.
Yeah, very wet tomorrow. That kind of turns them off when you go out in the pouring rain. But yeah, that's field geology class. I take them out 6 or 7 times because I told you I went into this so I could walk around in the woods. So I share that with my whole class. All right, you're going to go walk around in the woods. So yes, I take them out on, you know, geology is inherently a hands-on type of science, you know. You pick up rocks and you walk around in the woods and things like that. And a lot of it involves field work. So, you know, and that's pretty much, you've got to kind of put your hands on things if you're going to do field work. So
maybe you need another Indiana Jones movie or something. Marry it together with the archaeology.
Absolutely, except we'll make it geology.
Alec Gates, it's been great talking to you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.